The rather sobering news is that even though I'm sure, like myself, you'll be working like hell to make sure that Trumpism is defeated in November 2018 and November 2020, the fact of the matter is, I'm afraid to say, that Trumpism as a phenomenon will be with us for some time to come. It's not a one-off, it's not necessarily a deviation from the broad scope of US history, it's more like a culmination for reasons I'll try to at least sketch generally. And given the fact that it may be with us for some time to come, it's well past time not only to develop a new strategy, but also perhaps to develop a new concept of why it is that US imperialism exists, or more to the point, why are we in North America at this moment speaking English when we could just as well have been speaking Dutch, or just as well been speaking a number of Native American languages with simultaneous translation? And in order to get to a point that we can answer that question, it may be useful to begin with by examining a number of recent incidents and asking why. I'm sure you're familiar with the Philadelphia Starbucks incident, the barbecuing while black incident in Oakland, the black woman arrested for studying at a common space in Yale, all of the police killings of Eric Garner and Philando Castile and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland. And I think that we should begin to draw reasonable inferences from uncontested facts. That is to say, during the war in Vietnam, the question often was this genocidal war some sort of one-off, some sort of deviation from US imperialism, or whether it was the logical working out of the contradictions of US imperialism. And likewise, with regard to what's happening to a significant part of the citizenry of this country, we need to ask ourselves, is this just a coincidence, all of these police killings and arrests and calling the police? Or is there something deeper at play? And if there is something deeper at play, what is it? Well, fortunately, I think it's also fair to say that some of the liberal scholars have been doing a fair job of answering these questions, in some ways better than the scholars who consider themselves to the left of liberalism. I mean, for example, the book by Robert Parkinson, The Common Cause, on 1776, the founding of the United States, the common cause being massive dispossession of the indigenous and continued enslavement of the Africans. Or the recent book by Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman, The Framer's Coup, and look at the Constitution. Unlike many of our friends on the left who see the Constitution as the last word and, quote, democracy, unquote, as the title of this book suggests, he takes a more pinched view, which actually is part of the schizophrenic view of many of our friends on the left, who oftentimes at once celebrate this archaic, antiquated document, yet lament its fruits, be it the Electoral College, which allows a person to get fewer votes in 2016 and still be elected president, which of course stems from a decision in the late 18th century to give more weight to slave-owning states, or even the Second Amendment, which leads to these mass shootings, which can erupt at any second, and particularly they seem to be erupting in churches and high schools as of late, which, as you know, stems from this fear of uprisings by the indigenous population and uprising by enslaved Africans, and therefore there was a need for citizen militias in order to suppress them, and therefore it was decided that a better part of wisdom was to make sure that the population is armed. Now, or at least the Euro-American population is armed, I should say, to correct myself. So the point that I'm making is that if you look at the history of this country, it's fair to say that the revolt against British rule that led to the formation of the United States in the late 18th century, which has led to us communicating in this language developed in Northwest Europe, was driven in no small measure by A, the decision by London in 1763 with the royal proclamation to keep the settlers led by real estate speculator number one, George Washington, from moving further west, coming into conflict with the Native Americans, causing London to expend tremendous amounts of blood and treasure to propel that illicit process. And rather than see that kind of process end, the settlers led by George Washington kicked out London. And secondly, Somerset's case in June 1772, where England abolished slavery, and there was this fear that this decision would leapfrog the Atlantic, jeopardizing fortunes of a murderer's row of founding fathers, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, etc. And they kicked London out. Now, any of you who know anything about settlers' revolts, be it Algeria in the late 1950s or Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, in 1965, know that they're inherently problematic. Or any of you who know anything about settler colonialism, be it in North America today or what used to be called historic Palestine, now Israel, for example, or Australia, beginning after, interestingly enough, the British are kicked out of what is now the United States, know that it involves mass dispossession of an indigenous population and a sort of installation into power of a favored class of individuals. And what's interesting about the United States is its construction of whiteness. That is to say, those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, British versus German, German versus Pole, German versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Greek versus Macedonian, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian, once they crossed the Atlantic, voila, magically they're transmuted into this new identity politics, a militarized identity politics, if you like, of whiteness. Now, at once, this helps to reconcile conflicts and differences that they might have endured in Europe, particularly like English versus Irish, one of the first aspects of this construction of whiteness. But second of all, it's sort of what we used to call in the trade union movement a kind of pork chop unity. That is to say, they're united on this reactionary platform and premise of looting the indigenous and enslaving on a mass basis the Africans. And so I think that in terms of developing a new strategy for the left, it may be useful to go back to re-examine the history of this country, and out of the examination of the history of this country, perhaps we can develop a new strategy. I should also say that if you look at the broad expanse of North Atlantic history, it's quite striking to note how at issue in terms of mass transformations and what were thought to be progressive transformations was oftentimes the question of slavery and dispossession. I mean, if you look at the so-called Glorious Revolution in England in 1688, you see that the merchants rise up against the monarch because they want to elbow their way into the lucrative nature of the African slave trade, which oftentimes delivers profits of 1,700%. And so they clip the wings of the monarch and then call for the deregulation of the African slave trade and free trade in Africans, which leads to people like myself winding up in North America. Or as noted about 1776, a similar process, or 1836 with Texas seceding from Mexico because Mexico had moved towards abolition in the 1820s, and then the final defeat in 1861 with the Confederate States of America. So given the fact that profit through enslavement has been a driving force in the history of the North Atlantic nations, particularly in the United States of America, it should not be surprising that we see these incidents in Oakland and in Philadelphia, et cetera, nor should it be surprising that given the fact that one of the largest uncompensated expropriations of private property up to that point was the expropriation of property in the bodies of enslaved Africans in 1865. Oftentimes when describing this to my students, and being students in 2018, they're oftentimes fiddling with their smartphones as I'm talking, and I'll go up and grab their smartphone and say, "This is what's called an uncompensated expropriation of private property." And I'm sure you're not happy about that. You might even want to take me outside and thrash me. Well, this is, of course, what happened in 1865 in Dixie. So no wonder a Ku Klux Klan arises. No wonder we're still bedeviled by the legacy of that rather tortured and troubled history. And little wonder that many of our elite analysts are talking about fascism today, be it Madeleine Albright in her book Fascism, A Warning, or the Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein and Can It Happen Here? A play on the novel It Can Happen Here from the 1930s about the rise of fascism, or the deceased novelist Philip Roth in his book The Plot Against America, Michael Kinsley, or Timothy Snyder of Yale and tyranny and the road to unfreedom, unfreedom of course being sort of a euphemism for fascism, or Michael Kinsley, an heir to the Microsoft fortune through marriage, who first sounded alarm about Trump as a fascist. But the problem with their analyses is not, number one, they don't seem to see a connection between fascism arising in a country that tolerated slavery and apartheid for centuries and decades, and how that creates a fertile womb for the rise of fascism, I guess because they think it's normalized behavior to treat black people in a fascist manner, and that everybody else can sort of go along and escape, basically. And number two, with regard to U.S. foreign policy, they don't draw a connection between helping to engineer a fascist coup in Chile on September 11, 1973, or backing apartheid South Africa into a mixed tactical retreat in the spring of 1994. They don't see a connection between that foreign policy and how that creates the seeds for fascism here. That's where we should be able to intervene. And I know that my time, I mean, I'll have time to elaborate on these points further. So the other historical point I'd like to make is that if you look at the broad expanse of history over the last few hundred years, you'll see that in the North Atlantic nations in particular, there has been this transition from religious conflict, Protestant versus Catholic in Great Britain, for example, and Catholic versus Muslim in terms of the Crusades, and Catholic, Christian versus Jewish, for example, in Europe. And then crossing the Atlantic and then the advent of settler colonialism, you see, as particularly embodied in the First Amendment, a transition from religion as an axis of society to race as an axis of society. And of course, many of our liberal historians, they'll celebrate the First Amendment, talking about this movement away from religious sectarianism, but don't flip the coin over and look that it's really just replaced by race. And the same holds true for colonialism as well, which oftentimes was pivoted upon the point of race. Now, what happens to change that oftentimes are external events. The Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, leads to a general crisis of the entire slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, which then, with slavery abolished, that helps to give impetus to a class-based movement. It's no accident that struggles for an eight-hour day, the struggles of the Knights of Labor and union movements erupt in North America in particular after the U.S. Civil War and the abolition of slavery. But what's happened as we've gone from this transition from religion to race to class is that obviously the class-based project has suffered grievous wounds. So there's no surprise that, for example, in Italy, which once boasted one of the largest and most significant left-wing movements in the capitalist world, now you have the rise of a certain kind of neo-fascism. Nor is it surprising that in North America, in the 1950s, when the fateful decision was made to retreat from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow by dint of Brown versus Board of Education, followed by Civil Rights Acts, et cetera, at the same time, you have this advance on the race front, you have a retreat on the class front, because that's accompanied by this Red Scare attack on progressive trade unions, International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union, National Maritime Union, et cetera. And so that leads to this rather blinkered idea that the US ruling elite cares more about black people than they do about the so-called white working class, because as you know, class is a race phenomenon. When you talk about class, you only could talk about the white working class. And then that helps to plant seeds that then gives rise to this phenomenon of Trumpism. But I think to conclude, the point that I'm trying to make is that if you look at the broad expanse and broad scope of North American settler colonialism followed by U.S. history, that progressive transformation oftentimes has been induced by external factors, be it the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, be it the rise of a socialist camp and national liberation movements that puts pressure on the United States to move away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. And so part of the lesson in terms of developing a new strategy for the left and to make it and to put it on a micro level is that in a few weeks there will be an election in Mexico where a left-wing candidate is now leading in the polls, but of course he's led in the polls before and has been defeated. But let's say that this proves out, it seems to me that that opens up a wonderful opportunity for the left, particularly given the large population of Mexican descent, not only in the Southwest in California, but also right here in New York City, where we can link the local and the global. We can begin to expand the battlefield to our benefit. And then finally, taking advantage of what Trump has done for us. What has he done for us, you ask? Well, he's helped to introduce rifts into the capitalist world. I'm sure you must have seen what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said, and of course, he's not necessarily one of our radical left friends, but I think that it reflects a growing sentiment in Canada with regard to what's happening in the United States, with regard to what's happening in Germany concerning this negative reaction to Trumpism. We already know about the growth of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. So I think there's a possibility for creating this global movement that we can now facilitate because we have such useful instruments as the Real News, we have the use of the internet, which allows us to communicate instantaneously around the world. And then we have these large populations of immigrants that are coming under fire who, even if we weren't thinking strategically and globally, we would be duty bound to come to their defense and assistance in any case. But we have even more of an opportunity and a reason to come to their defense and aid because now we see it as part of a larger global strategy based on history, based on the history of progress in North America, that then will undergird a new strategy for the left. Thank you very much.